Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
And it's just us.
Just us. Yeah, it turns out the other half of our podcast, Bryce and Brian, are off on a top secret project for the next 24 hours or so, and they will not be joining us today. But you want to know what? Hell, this podcast started in a warehouse in Margate, Florida, with just me and Andrew Main. And then that freeloader Brushwood horned his way into this. And then, you know, Bryce, who is the opposite.
He's like, please, 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 can I be a part of it? We're like, no, Brian, no. We don't want your huge fan base. We don't want your professionalism. We don't want your constant eagerness and interest in the, you know, science and skepticism to infiltrate our podcast.
Exactly.
He's like, please. We're like, fine.
And so now, after much non-existent demand, we are bringing back the original, probably never before heard format of the Weird Things podcast. So here we go, doing the show the way nature intended. Andrew, what's going on?
Well, I have a question for you. When did we start doing the Weird Things? I have like one interesting Andrew fact we had a couple before the show is, I have like zero concept of my own history. Yeah. I have to look. To ask me when something happened, I have to be like I know specifically when I shot one TV pilot years ago, because I remember looking at I remember watching video clips of the cell phone and the date appearing on the phone. Uh-huh. That's how I know when that is. I know when I was performing in Japan because I had a jacket made with the leather jacket with the year on the back. Other than that, I'm bad.
Yeah. God, I have no idea other than to say that I actually was thinking about iTrix last week, the magic site that we started so many years ago, because a big story fairly early on our magic blog, and that is, of course, Ta-Da, not The Gathering, was the 10-year deal struck between Chris Angel and Cirque du Soleil,
which
then turned into The Believe Show, is currently Mind Freak Live, and is coming to an end. It was in 2008 when that deal went on, and credit to Chris Angel, they ran through. That is not a town where long-term deals very often go as long as they are, but that deal is ending, and those two sides are parting ways. But it just put it into context, like, wow, that was 10 years ago when we first covered that.
Yeah, I'm looking at images and stuff. I'm looking at from Weird Things back in 2008. Of course, none of the images work. And looking up info stuff there. Yeah, I guess it's like 10 years. Man, so that brings me a question I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
Here we are 10 years later.
Yeah.
Podcasting, right? And podcasting existed, you know, before we certainly started this. And I remember doing, and I think you were helped at some point, the James Randi, the radio show for the Amazing Randi. You know, we did the Amazing Show.
Yeah, I was, if not the intern then, close to that period of time. And I went in, was it WIOD?
Yeah, there was a point at which we had we tried this. We did this thing on, I don't know if we went from the radio, because I think somebody, one of his sponsors, bought him radio time. And okay. So we did it on a radio station. And then we did it, maybe went from there. We did it from the office. And podcasting and RSS really weren't a format at that time. And no. So what we had to do was we had to use Real Player or whatever. And it was the most precarious of setups you could imagine, with a phone cord, like, you know, hooked up, and oh man, the world changed. But yeah.
No, yeah. So that was live streaming audio. This is pre-podcast. Yeah. This is pre I mean, certainly pre-Twitch, pre-any kind of like mainstream, pre-Ustream, pre-Justin TV. This was just that whatever protocol that was on Real Player, if you had your Real Player also open, you could find this broadcast that was happening.
Yeah, we could have a, we'd have a link. We'd say, hey, we're going, telling people when you're going to go live was kind of important to sort of that part of it. And then and you could save the files, of course, which back in the day was huge. But ours has been a thing for a while. But the concept of podcasting, yes, and that is, it's well over a decade. So a while is a relative term. But as far as using podcasts and RSS together, that's the thing. And that's what we were trying to explain, was that, you know, the idea that somebody said, oh, let's use this as a way to distribute audio files or whatever. That was the revolution, so to speak, in podcasting. It's because it became a very easier way to subscribe and follow us. Somebody said, well, let's use this RSS feed format and combine it with this other thing. So anyhow, we digress. My question is, I don't think if you had asked us 10 years ago, mm-hmm. you know, what would the medium look like? What would podcasting be like today? I think we'd have agreed that, oh, yeah, podcasting will be a thing. It'll be a popular thing. Where do you think it would have been today?
Well, I mean, I think that probably the popular theory 10 years ago, and again, I mean, just to, I know that we're kind of confusing timelines a little bit, but like the James Randi show was like 6 years before the 10 year mark that we are talking about right now. I think the popular theory was that this was going to be television, and the way that YouTube effectively became television, that we would understand. At that point, DVRs had just started to become a thing. On demand kind of broadcasting was the idea. So if I were to trace the lines forward and project, my guess would have been more along the lines of the, you know, a Revision 3 idea that like, no, we're creating the brands of the future on video RSS. And that now the next step forward is going to be, you're going to want to get your televisions with your RSS feeds built in that will seamlessly blend your cable television with the hot new thing, which will be video RSS feeds.
Interesting. I think I always sort of assumed, not always, I'll tell you the point at which I realized this. I always assumed that audio would be big, that audio as a form of entertainment would be big. And of all places, this sort of hit me watching The Fifth Element, the Luc Besson movie. With the Ruby Rod show, where you had Chris Tucker played this character who was in the future, Fifth Element, love that movie, right? Yeah. Far future. And possibly the most annoying person in the entire universe has this radio show, the Ruby Rod show. And it's a radio show, but he's a radio show. What makes it futuristic is he records it from a staff thing that he carries around with him, and he can go anywhere, walk anywhere, and he's doing this show. And I thought, like, and it's radio, and people listen to him.
Audio.
Radio. And
yeah.
And I remember thinking about, like, you know, everybody when they do futuristic sort of movies and stuff, and or books even, you know, they talk about, you know, the hologram machine. And it was funny because I'm listening to Isaac Asimov's The Naked Sun, part of his Elijah Bailey detective stories about man and robots and stuff. And it's a very interesting sort of world building, which you could get into another time. I mean, this is something written in the 50s, I believe. But he talks about like going to this, there's in this world, it's thousands of years in the future. Earth's rebuilt, collapsed, rebuilt several times. There's a New York City that's at the same place there's been in New York City, but everybody lives inside this giant, massive cavern. So average humans have never gone outside of the cavern, what have you, except for this detective who's been sent going out to space to go to this far off planet that humans have colonized. And they have the spacers, which are these a bit way more advanced than us. They use robots for everything. On one planet, they'll have 20,000 people living and 200 million robots to do their labor.
Oh, wow.
And he goes, this futuristic house, which was built just for him, it'll be destroyed when he's gone because the robot economy. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. It's Asimov talking about the AI economy or the robot economy back then. And he talks about, he walks around the house, then he goes into the, you know, kind of the library. and they have all the book films up there and three book viewers, which is the idea that, you know, we're going to need something to look at the book viewers. And then an animation screen, a 27-inch animation screen.
Nice.
You know, and but it was that idea of like, okay, that's like their version of like a video screen or something like that. But it was an interesting kind of sort of, you know, take on that and thinking about futuristic stories. We want to have like, we have the 3D caster, the holocaster and this. But in The Fifth Element, it's like, oh, yeah, we'll listen to radio. And I'm like, huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when podcasting came along, I'm like, yeah, I guess this is a format with a future. But I will tell you what I think what disrupted things. I think that podcasting, we would have been here a couple years. We would have been here 5 years ago. I think we would have had Patreon-like groups or, you know, like companies. I think we would have had like Anchor FM, what they're trying to do. There were attempts like that. There was a podcasting boom back about 10 years ago, 2008, you know, there's a lot of investment in it.
Oh, yeah.
But I think what's that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I agree. Yep.
Yeah, I think the disruptive force was YouTube. I think that, like, when YouTube first came out in 2006, it's funny, I can tell you when, like, companies came out. That's like my own personal history, no idea. YouTube came out 2006, and it was, oh, it's kind of cool. All right. Yeah, I just uploaded to YouTube. It was like Flickr for their videos.
Yeah.
And then it was slow, then kind of big, then all at once. The next thing you know, YouTube is the number one source of content for, you know, people under the age of 18.
Yeah, you know, I mean, YouTube was so disruptive because it had almost built up this audience before anybody realized that putting stuff up on there was a good idea. Like, mm-hmm. because of the pirated content by and large. But that's,
yeah.
I think everybody, if you were there at the birth of YouTube, you, if you're like me, you first discovered YouTube because you were Googling something and the YouTube link was the first link that was there. And I remember it was one of those, there are two services that I had this experience with. One was Wikipedia, the other was YouTube, where I was Googling something and then it's like, oh my God, what is this treasure on the internet? And I mm-hmm. found some old football highlight that I just randomly had thought of. I'm like, oh, I wonder if I could find this clip somewhere, uploaded to some weird sports blog or something like that. Nope, it's on YouTube, and for whatever reason, it's not getting pulled down. And then, you know, it had built this audience where it's like, oh wow, I mean, all right, well, once I've already watched that, oh, you know what's on there now? This other cool thing that people uploaded, and you have all these early proto YouTube series like Thing a Day and stuff like that that just kind of populated that space.
It kept coming back, but I think that it's, you know, that could be an after things discussion too about sometimes the model for a company to grow is actually to look the other way. And YouTube really did that with pirated content because YouTube looked at what was getting their biggest views and it was, hey, we'll take this clip from SNL, let's do this, let's do that. And they had huge, huge, huge growth. And then when Google bought them, Google had to, now that Google, you know, was a much bigger corporate entity, they were faced with trying to kind of clean that up, but not too aggressively. There are a lot of things they could have done. We dealt with this too, like, you know, my magic videos mm-hmm. getting uploaded to YouTube all the time. And there was, you know, there, it's like, well, it's hard to tell people upload. I'm like, I don't know, like, I could give you a couple keywords that you could flag me every time this happens. And, you know, we could a fingerprint, an audio print of something is doable, but you know, they just had no, they were incentivized not to be aggressive about doing that until it affected their ability to get advertisers and work with larger media partners.
And now it's, I mean, they're certainly more aggressive, but oftentimes frustratingly inconsistent in exactly like what is allowed and what isn't. I had a thing on the politics podcast where I was talking about the new Sacha Baron Cohen series, and I played a soundless clip in the background so as to illustrate that this is a thing, just to make it more visually interesting. I'm still the dominant part of the screen, and that gets flagged. You know, because a soundless, it doesn't match, but it certainly was the video. It figured out what the video was and
interesting
and flagged it. It is crazy. But I mean, you're right. Like sometimes you got to do the wrong thing to do the right thing, I guess, if the right thing is success.
So 10 years from now.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be people on microphones and audio. There's going to be that. We're looking on the brink of things like augmented reality and other stuff. And the question often is how much these things become part of our lives, and they change our lives often subtly, but maybe, you know, I think augmented reality is cool. Do I think that if I have the latest Google or Apple pair of augmented reality glasses, I'm going to put them on when I wake up and I'm going to take them off when I go to sleep? Or is it, you know, I think it's more like my, you know, and we've talked about this before, Brian, like my kind of thought is it's like when I sit down at my larger computer, you know, yeah. I'll put something on to go to this, you know, spend an hour or two doing it, but it's not like I'm going to wear it all day because now I'm a cyborg.
Well, yeah. And we do have a culture where glasses are a thing, and you have seen people try to push into that, be it in recording video or recording and broadcasting video, like we've seen with spectacles for Snapchat, but those haven't really caught on. I would tend to believe that there might be a place where a very lightweight, you know, important information when you need it kind of glasses could be something that I would be incentivized to keep on more or most of the day. But for what I think the future of augmented, I almost think that at this point, even in 2018, I see a different world for like lightweight bandwidth, you know, a bandwidth footprint that isn't too large, information that comes to my face, and the cool stuff that we could theoretically do with augmented reality. Like, I think that to me, no, I want to sit and enjoy that. I want to play a board game with you and Brian and a friend from New York at the same time that we're all looking at ourselves or the same board, more so than I want to, like, have that capability always on my face. Because I'm willing to sit down by myself and do that. I don't think I'm willing to walk around with a big bulky thing on my face all day.
Yeah, I can think of there's situations where it gets something. It's like your phone. Like I have all my notifications turned off. Now, there are points where I'll walk around in town down, you know, in the city, or walk around all day with my phone out if I'm using it to navigate. You know, yeah. I'll walk around if, you know, I want to use, you know, getting information on something. And I can see that there could be points where like, oh, you know, I'm going to go downtown. I want to go do a geo tour, play a game. I mean, I think that's the thing that just sort of explodes in my mind is that we don't know what the shape of things is going to be. We take where we are now and we imagine a version of this going forward. And cell phones and smartphones, I mean, it's funny because we still call them phones, but they have as much to do with a phone, you know.
Yeah.
As little. I mean, and that's the thing, is it's a device that I rarely ever make calls on this thing. This is all about my data and communications. And also, it's not like, oh, but now it's because I use it for web browsing. Like, no, because text messaging and things like this became so much easier. And one of the reasons text messaging works great is because it's this nonlinear asynchronous communications. And that's your asynchronous communications before text messaging was leaving voicemails with people. Or email, you know, but for mobile, but these things change.
So where do you see the landscape in 10 years?
I mean, any guess I'm going to make is going to be a stupid guess.
Let's all understand is that when this is brought, please clip this out and title it Andrew's Lock of the Century.
Promise, guarantee. Yeah.
The decade final projections for 10 years from now. But what do you think it looks like?
You know, because I'm going to say, I'll preface something by YouTube became what people wanted to change it into. The YouTube creators had ideas for what they wanted this to be and what it could do. And I don't think they were resistant to where it ended up. But what YouTube became was really how people chose to use the platform and the way people found to use it. And you can sort of think like you set up a platform. And this is how the creators are going to use the platform. But then how the audience wants the creators to use the platform, it changes things considerably. And that's a big thing, is that like, I'm going to create this content like this. And then you realize, wait, there's an audience over here, just a little to the right. If I do shorter videos, engage in the comment sections more, or I do this, or I do that. And you're like, oh, yeah, I can do that, and I do that. And then people are like, we like this. And so somebody else goes, oh, I guess I need to do that too. And then mediums change. I think that one of the things with formats, and the thing that's been talked about a lot, you know, it's not a novel idea, is micro episodes. I think the idea of doing micro episodes of shows is sort of a, instead of, hey, we're going to do, you know, I mean, for us to like to get together, talk to each other, it's more sense for us to talk for an hour than to try to talk five times per week. But for us to put together a show, to do a weird thing show that could actually be a weird thing stream, where it's like, hey, you know, like, we're going to talk about this, but then we're going to throw up these other segments into the feed that are going to come through with periodically, a couple minutes here, a couple minutes there, whatever. I could see a lot of, I could see that being a cool destination. Cause then what you do is you follow a lot of your content like that. Is that you get 2 minutes of your favorite sports show, cause they put something up, you get 3 minutes of your favorite media show that comes up, and like that. So I think that the formats will be probably one of the bigger changes. I think it's still gonna, you know, there'll be audio, there'll be video further out. Like, yeah, augmented, you're going to do augmented reality, you know, live streams when it's really cool to do that. You know, if you get somebody who's, you know, doing something cool or whatever we want to go follow. Daily short shows seem to be a thing now, especially like there have been since podcasting micro episodes, but as far as a thing, you know, there was video before YouTube, there's Metacast, there was a lot of stuff there, but yeah, those things. But as far as how we sort of consume those sort of stuff and all that, and that, like, yeah, no, that's those things been there, but it's like there's a point at which podcasting became bigger, you know, bigger and stuff. But yeah, I think that anyhow, I think that, like, when you get into AR and stuff like that, I don't think it's like you're watching the, you know, the part of it, how much production time do you want? Like, for us to do a weird thing show in AR, I could see that, like, that you're going to be a system where it's like, oh, we'll have, you know, 3D versions of ourselves. It'll be a fun environment where people can watch it. I don't think you get anything more out of that. But if we have, you know, cool AR glasses and we do what we did, like, long back again, you know, we did the weird things live things.
Yeah.
That's cool. I think if you can get rid of, if we can make the production tools easier, we'll get new forms of content.
So your bets are in a shifting, more digestible content and more rich media where it is available and where we create better tools to put it together.
Yeah, I'd like to, you know, I would consume more stuff, but a lot of these mediums fall into the same problem that TV does, is that our books do. Like, the problem with novels in the book publishing industry is that a book needs to be a widely released published novel generally needs to be, you know, 80,000, 100,000 words long or longer. It needs to be that big because it's hard, because you can charge a certain amount of money for something, a print book that big. If you're trying to do a book that's much smaller, it's harder. Now, the YA market's different. The young adult market has changed things. It's one of the reasons this traditional book industry is still managing. But it, you, because of the cost of designing covers, doing this, do this, is the book industry is not able to do things that make less money and sell fewer quantities, even though you could do more per unit. They're just not designed to do that. In YouTube shows, things like that, you've seen that, like, for pro content, is that you see that people tend to, well, I've got to make my shows kind of this length, I've got to have these bumpers, I've got to have it this size, and probably if I want to be a pro YouTuber, I need to be doing multiple channels or multiple shows.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where it's sort of grown that way instead of linearly, I guess. So, Jay Calhoun says, I think super short clips might work on Twitter, Facebook, or Shap, or Instagram more than YouTube. I don't think YouTube is, I think you're right. I don't think YouTube is, I don't like to go to YouTube because the commercials annoy the hell out of me. I really don't like to go there, and I'm the exception.
But you can get them without, on YouTube Premium, it's not red anymore because that sounded too much like red tube, but
you would have think they would have noticed that when they launched it.
Yeah, I might have. Well, although that's a Google thing, they love launching a thing and then renaming it 5 days later. Yeah. That's like their jam.
Yeah, I know they have these other thing forms, and that's, you know, we'll see. So, but yeah, I think that's going to be certainly a thing. I think you're going to get more you know, I think as models to support content creation, I think Patreon kind of nailed it. You know, I think Patreon really, I think there's room, tremendous room for improvement, and not to say that other people won't copy that model and make a better version of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, Patreon, if you go back and you read kind of speculative stuff from the 1990s and the ideas of the first, you know, hey, crowdsourcing to be cool if you could do this or this or this.
Yeah.
Those models were out there ready for somebody to go take to try to do, you know, take them on. The problem is understanding what scale you want to do it at. And the scale of the podcaster level scale made the most sense. And it was like, we'll start with people. Let's have people already have audiences and help them monetize rather than start with no audience and try to monetize.
I think that there was also just a time and place for that, you know, because, you know, pay what you want albums had been a thing, and Radiohead did one where it was they did one, and it was not quite the. I mean, it was at least not enough of a success that they didn't they did one again, right? And I think that there's
I want to address on that too, because that was we had these conversations at the time about that because. One of my most upvoted and downvoted posts ever was that, you know, like online tip jars are a jar full of fail because it's counter to consumer behavior, whatever. And like these one-time album things. And I, you know, like you and I kind of like, yeah, it's a great gimmick once, but it's not a model. It's not a model. And because we'll know it's a model when we see the people who did them continue to do this. And they didn't continue to do that.
Sure, yeah. And I think that part of it is expectation. You know, if you expect to make X on an album because you are a top rock band and you make Y and it's less, then you're going to ask why. Why did I make less doing this than the traditional route? And is the freedom that I gained by owning that material worth it? The other side of it is just how many people were online and wanted to do stuff. And I think that there was an entire culture of understanding, okay, I'm going to put my credit card on the internet and I'm going to keep it on a platform and I'm going to feel free to exercise that, you know, my money via this platform for a bunch of stuff. And I think iTunes really did a lot for that. iTunes and Amazon to me were the first two times they really were the trailblazers for, I can put my credit card on the internet, which is like one of those things that I think will kind of be lost to history because it just happened in a way that people feel is natural. But it took a while for that to trickle down. And I think the idea of iTunes having the dollar, oh, I like this song, I'll buy this song for a dollar. It's worth it for me to put my credit card on the internet to buy this dollar thing did a lot for sites like Patreon, where it's like now, I don't know. We still haven't seen the major band start to say, no, Patreon's the way that I make money. But we've certainly seen smaller bands, and we've seen bands launch with non-traditional means and then take advantage of larger platforms. So the idea of pay what you want for many is the model for many Patreons, including this one, because we do a free show and you're allowed to pay what you want. The show's not going to stop if you don't, but it took a long way to get there, and I'll be curious to see where it goes from here. The first mover advantage that Patreon has is that, man, once you've started moving money around on a platform, boy, does it take a lot to make you not to revoke that trust.
There was a, and I forgot who said it, but it was this, it was an observation like, you know, Zuckerberg described Facebook as a platform, and maybe it was Bill Gates or somebody was commenting, or somebody is like, it's not a platform when you, the person who created it, is making all of the money on it. A platform is something where other people come to and they make money by it. And there, it's worthwhile to invest time in doing this. Facebook's been problematic for, like, you know, news and other things like this. If you have experimental budget, you'll try it, but nobody sort of trusts them or the institution to try to build something longer term, whatever.
Because it's out and out hostile to new businesses and communities. It trapped other established communities in a sarcophagus and then held everybody, held the creators up for money, the large creators up for money.
Yeah.
So it's like when I was looking to do the politics stuff, I'm like, all right, I want to take the politics stuff more seriously. I want to go where people share political thought. And I went to Facebook and I watched each post get less and less traction, mm-hmm. despite the fact that more and more people were joining on. And each time, every day, the Facebook bag man came to my door and said, hey, you've got a lot of people here. They'd really like seeing this thing. And I'm like, well, so what? I'm going to begin this usurious relationship with you where I'm just paying you every single day? No, I'll
for
do email.
Every person that you brought as a subscriber
to you. That I leveraged my own stuff to bring them here? No. So I pushed it to an email list, and within 5 months, we've got 1,000 people on an email list. And they get it every single day for free on a free service. And the only relationship I have now is with MailChimp, where it's like, when it doubles that size, I'll start having to pay a little bit. But at that point, it'll probably be worth, I can probably pay for it in Amazon affiliate links if I want.
Oh, for sure. Sure. And, you know, here's the thing is that let's talk about that for a moment.
Let's put a pin in this because we're at our Patreon plug again. Patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go to support this show. You can get the After Things program, which will actually happen today because I'm around, which is good. You'll get it early because we care about you. After Things, of course, is the show where we talk about making the things that you love and share real stories from our independent creator lives. And you can support all of it by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. Do it now. patreon.com/weirdthings.
So, you know, as far as Facebook as a platform and that, you know, we've talked about how changes they made. When you have any company, your goal is you have to increase your rate of growth, right?
Yeah.
If you're a publicly traded company, your stock price, your goal as a publicly traded company is to increase shareholder value, which means have your stock price grow. This is textbook. This is what company their value as a publicly traded company. Increase shareholder value is your duty. Now, you figure out how do we do this from, and there are different strategies for how you can do this. Is sometimes you just say, well, let's just go for short-term profitability. Let's just turn a profit, and so we can show that we can do this. And then, but that's really strategically long-term. It means that maybe you're going to have a curve at which you're not going to. That's why some companies, Amazon famously, Jeff Bezos is well like, I'm not going to try to turn a profit. Like, I'm not going to try to turn a profit anytime soon, because if I'm showing this profit, you know, if I'm turning a profit, whatever, that, hey, we didn't spend as much as we thought we didn't spend that. If we have this much money at the end of the year or whatever, he's like, that's money we could be using towards driving growth, building factories, building distribution centers, increasing customer satisfaction rates by speeding up shipping times or whatever, or lowering prices. His attitude was, I would rather those, you know, few cents in profit, I'd rather just reinvest them back into the company every quarter into growth and just growing. And there was, in the 90s when he did this, a lot of people were critical, like, hey, Jeff, we think this is kind of crazy. You know, Wall Street has this wave which you've gotten to a certain size now, show a profit. And every now and then they would do a profitable quarter to kind of show that we could kind of do
that they could. But also it was always, well, their margins are so thin, and one of these days someone else is going to come into the space, and those margins, you're going to feel like a real horse's ass because you spent all this time investing in a thing that you wound up getting disrupted.
You know, but what they built was not unlike Apple did with the Apple ecosystem for the iOS. As they said, let's keep reinvesting in little tiny little things that our fans will appreciate and will really like. How smooth the software works, making better hardware, doing this over time, that if you get into the Apple way of doing things, you don't want to do the other way. You can go to eBay to buy stuff. You can go other places to buy stuff. But if you're part of that Amazon system, from the moment you click, you find something to buy to getting it to you is amazing. And they've spent billions of dollars making it efficient. And that's been a very disruptive thing. When Amazon first started off selling books, I had friends in the book industry who were like, well, you know, once Barnes & Noble gets in, they're going to kick Amazon's ass.
Yeah.
You know, this is a fact. It was like, once Barnes & Noble decides to do this, nobody knows selling books, you know, being in, they've been doing it over 100 years. They know what they're doing. And I'm like, It's the internet. Like, what is that? What is different? I'm like, well, I'm like, it's a different way of distribution and stuff. I'm like, I didn't know, but I'm like, you know, what I read, it's like they put Amazon put their distribution center next to the warehouse, you know, where I'm like, yeah, but what if they decide to stop selling to them? I'm like, there are a lot of what ifs there, but it was just, you just sort of, you'd hear these sort of, you know, the sort of reaction, and then Amazon invested considerably into delivery and doing this, and then they got into their most profitable business, which most people are still unaware of, which is AWS, Amazon Web Services, which AWS was Amazon as it got bigger, their computing needs, their information needs, their storage needs, online needs were growing and growing and growing, and they were hiring from other people to build this. Then finally they're like, can we try to provide some of these services for our own divisions internally? Can we just do this internally? You know, and they said, yeah, let's try to do it internally, but we'll treat it as a separate standalone division that sells our services back to us or whatever. And they did it, and it was very successful. They better understood their own needs of what they were trying to do. And then they reached the point, they said, we think we can have the capacity and growth rate to sell these services outside of Amazon. And now, even if you do not have an Amazon Prime account or buy on Amazon, every single day you are using Amazon services, because from the images that are served, you know, from on screen, like every time I go to use some, you know, new web service or something like this, that, like, you know, business to business sort of service or whatever, when I start looking at where are my images stored, Amazon AWS. S3, you know, they're huge. They're as much, if you got rid of the fact that they sell you stuff and they do things to you, Amazon's web services valuation for that is enormous. Yeah. It's incredible.
We got into this conversation on Daily Tech News Show over the last week, because all the, they call it in the financial industry, the FANG companies,
Facebook, Apple,
Amazon, Netflix, and Google.
Yeah.
And you know, Amazon had an insane report last week that drove their stock, you know, into the stratosphere. And part of what my point was is, like, all right, so Facebook famously also last week had a very negative quarter.
I was going to bring that was the kind of a correction, and please continue. Yeah.
Yeah. So my point is that, like, all right, if Netflix could be disrupted by Disney, right? But it would probably take a little bit, you know, where next thing you know, all the cool things that you want to see on Netflix, is, you know, the big movies are on another platform. They have a couple years of bad choices for originals that they're making. They can be degraded, but it would take a little bit. Let's say in a fantasy world, Google really makes their money primarily. They have, you know, the big engine that drives them is AdWords. So if advertising was disrupted tomorrow, and now all of a sudden AdWords were just the worst thing on God's green earth to buy, there was a new really cool way to do it, you know, Google would be screwed, but it'd probably take a few years. Realistically, it would take a few years for that to trickle through. Amazon, among those companies, is probably the most protected, because if you were able to just, you know, through nanotechnology and 3D printers, create everything you've ever wanted in your house for free, they would still have AWS, right? And if all of a sudden the internet became totally decentralized and all storage was free, they'd still be there to sell you stuff every day. Facebook is the least protected, because Facebook's, unlike Google, where it's web, it's all over the web, they're selling to everybody, Facebook is determined by how many people they can pack into Facebook, and Facebook's popularity and stickiness with its core audience and with its growing audience really determines, like, they got to get you in the tent first and then convince people that, look at all these people in this tent, we're selling you advertising. As they hit growth problems, which part of it is them hitting the kill screen of the planet, if you look at how many people have the internet, they're getting to the point where it's like, you did it. You got everybody that was ever going to get on Facebook. Like, this is a problem.
Yeah, that was the Facebook. Yeah, Facebook's problems were several. In one, $100 billion market, the largest market correction ever. And I, you know, I part of it's schadenfreude, like, well, our experience of dealing with Facebook, like building audiences for them, then all of a sudden having, I've spent thousands of dollars trying to advertise to my own audience when I would have been, if had I known this was their plan, yeah. I never would have. And then, of course, that's, yeah, the haha, you didn't, that's why we didn't tell you. It's like, well, guess what? You just lost $100 billion in valuation there, and your platform is starting to decline because you've lost trust. You've lost trust with people who can pay for services and will do things and are less inclined to do that. Now, Facebook, what they did very, very smart was they realized kind of there's a, they realized they looked at growth rates of other social networks. They realized their competition was going to be Snapchat. It was going to be WhatsApp and all the WhatsApp. It was going to be these other, you know, ones coming up there. So they started buying them. You know, they could, yeah. They tried to buy Snap. They couldn't buy Snapchat. That story, you know, hilarious sort of story about that experience of trying to convince Evan Spiegel to sell. And then Zuckerberg's pitch was, well, look, we've already got this version of your site, of our own version of Snap that we're going to run. That's going to just going to kill you. Poke is just going to destroy you.
Yeah.
What? What? Didn't happen. Then it was like Slingshot, whatever they tried. And they kind of gave up. But then what they did is they took this other platform they bought called Instagram and kept adding Snap likes. Snapchat-like features. I keep calling it Snap because it's the company's name now.
Yeah, yeah.
They keep adding Snapchat-like features to it, and now Instagram has had really great growth rates. I don't go to Instagram as much anymore because for me, it's become a really crappy experience. It's all the reasons I hated Facebook. It's now getting creeping into Instagram.
Yeah.
I think there may be a curve to that. I think there may be a problem there. The problem is that when you're a starting company and you're growing, it's easy. Any little change to add some monetization looks great and your investors are very happy. But then you reach platform status level, like a huge platform like Facebook, it's problematic because you pointed out, you know, Facebook says, oh, you know, we got a billion people on the platform, but there's more billion people in the world. Yeah, but you got the billion highest incomes in the world.
Yeah.
You know, the rest of the other 6 billion people there, you add up all of their incomes, they're not worth, it doesn't equal 10%. Of the ad dollars of the first ones you got. So they tried to increase, there was the big push, remember it was like 4 or 5 years ago, we're going to increase daily active engagement. We're going to push to try to get people to stay on the platform later. Now they're putting out these commercials apologizing,
yes,
basically, for all of the things they did to establish that. My BFR is down. They apologize for all, and that's the funny thing, was like, well, this was your plan. You know, you,
this was the idea. Yeah. Yep. Was to interject more stuff into your newsfeed, to find the things that enraged you and made you want to sit there and gave you every social cue to make sure that that argument with your aunt about vaccines lasted well into the night and into next week, because that would mean that you're on the platform longer. And now, mm-hmm. This is part of the problem. But I think you're right. To me, if I was going to be bearish on any of those FANG companies, it is Facebook for me that I am the most bearish on, because I think that when it goes bad, again, assuming it can go bad for all those companies, Apple products could go out of fashion, and so all of a sudden their hardware and their software is not as relevant and sticky, right? And Netflix can be disrupted. Amazon, it would take two gigantic, massive things to happen, and Amazon not to course correct for it, but theoretically it could all happen. Facebook's the one where it, to me, happens the fastest.
You know, I could see a drop in valuation like we saw, which we certainly saw, so your point is absolutely correct on that. The thing is that you have to step back and kind of look at, like, what is Facebook doing that, you know, they bought Oculus, you know, they bought WhatsApp, they bought Instagram. They're buying a bunch of these other companies and building a portfolio like Microsoft did. When Microsoft realized the biggest threat to Microsoft was the internet. And when you go back and you look at what happened in the 1990s, sort of the browser wars and how Microsoft, you know, played as dirty as they could get away with and sometimes didn't. The reason was Microsoft saw a future where the web browser was the iOS. The web browser was the way you used apps and you used services. They realized this is where things were going. And they thought, you know what? You know, because Microsoft was afraid of a future where you had things like Salesforce, where you had, you know, Google Docs and all these other things, because they were afraid of that could be impact their business. And they got into a lot of other sort of categories, kind of like IBM did. And Facebook, I think, I mean, that's been their strategy. That's been their strategy is let's acquire like any other social network we can, you know, to continue our growth and then get into other places and gaming, stuff like this. But, you know, I would say the problem is, like, the brand is damaged. I think the brand name is damaged.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, those platforms that they bought, like WhatsApp has said that they were not going to have ads, right? Like that is part of the idea of that company. It's part of the reason why they became as popular as they did. And now we're probably at some point, long enough timeline, probably going to see ads on there. Certainly seen a lot more ads on Instagram. We're probably going to see more ads interstitially in those in the stories as you're thumbing through that. But it's harder to jam more ads. Like, you don't realize with Google how many ads they jam down your throat on a daily basis. Like, it is, go ahead and type like cable in your city, right? Into your Google search bar and see how far down that page all those things are sponsored. And that's before you get into all the ads that follow you around the internet that are often served by Google. Facebook is different, where it's like, all right, so let's say Instagram grows and grows and grows and grows. How many display ads are you going to be able to interject into somebody's daily life? Where I think Facebook's more conducive to doing it, but yet I think that they damage their brand by damaging trust in their platform, and they're obviously regretting it since they apologize to me every time I turn on the television. But whether or not they'll be able to make it better,
I was being part of that. It's like, it's kind of the apologies more like, oh, we're going to try to help fight clickbait more and blah, blah, blah. We should have been doing more, and not so much, yeah, no, we push this at you. It's not really kind of admitting. It's a very Zuckerbergian sort of, you know.
Yeah. On the scale of who's apologizing to me better on television currently, Uber is apologizing to me more directly than Facebook. Facebook, you're right. Facebook is like, well, we invented a pure, beautiful platform, and then it got corrupted. How did that happen? We don't know, but we're going to fix it, right? Uber's like, we fired our CEO, and now we have a very nice Indian man who will help you because he's not the mean old guy.
Yeah, who built the platform to the point that it is.
Yeah.
And that's part of it, is that interesting thing is where the era of apologies, where companies apologizing for the things they had to do to get to the size they are. That's kind of the reality, is that we'd like to believe in some other. I mean, I can think of a world where Facebook could have gotten bigger by taking a longer term, you know, like an Amazon sort of strategy of like, what can we build out? What can we do? I mean, I could very easily see myself as a business customer paying them, you know, $50, $100 a month for really good tools and systems for engaging with people like I do. Like, I pay MailChimp a lot, and I hardly even use MailChimp. Most months I don't even use MailChimp, and I still pay them because when I want to send an email, MailChimp works out really well, you know? And I could see a world where Facebook could have built some system like that, and I would be a loyal kind of customer and maybe periodically adding new services. But because that's not the way they did it, now I think there's, again, they're always going to be around, you know,
I think that they're a part of the fabric at this point, but you're right. I mean, look, again, I tried to start a community there. I tried to play by their rules, and I was barely out of the starting blocks before they were asking me for money. And it's like, I mean, come on, like, at least get my foot in the door. But it made it, I'm almost glad that they did, because it's like, well, at least I didn't put a bunch of people there, and then they started poking me in the wallet and seeing what coins fell out. You know, at least Google's like, all right, look, we're not going to ask everybody for money. We're going to ask people that want to advertise. We're going to make it very simple on a small budget to have very speculative kind of advertising that's worth risks and that's worth experimentation. And Facebook has that, but it's like, man, I think that they wound up spreading that net just a little too wide for the creator side. And then for the consumer side, I don't know. I'm an atypical Facebook user because I'm on the internet and I've been accepting every friend request I've gotten since forever. So my experience is not everybody's experience, but it is just unusable for me. Like, I can't get the stuff that I want. The people that are there are just annoying. It's never the content that I want. It never makes me happy. I deleted it off my phone, and I've never been more thrilled except for realizing how many times I've used Facebook Authenticator on other apps where it tries to, it forces me to download the Facebook app for 2 seconds so I can delete it. But yeah, it's just
yeah, I was professionally frustrated with it when I had like 20,000 plus, you know, people on my fan page. And then when I realized, my post is being read by 12 people, you know, like, if you want them all, why? Oh, wow. It's low engagement. Like, oh, no, we just didn't show it to everybody. Oh, so all the people that signed up to get my post, like, no, but they can go in now and they can switch. They can press a different button now to always see your posts. I'm like, but I already have them on board. How do I tell them to go do this thing?
Yeah.
Well, you can pay a... It was horrible. And then as a regular consumer, like, I had the app on my phone and every now and then I'd get a Facebook email message and I'd be like, oh, okay, respond to this. It's not my preferred way to contact, you know, whatever, but I'll respond. And then they're like, hey, we're moving messages out of Facebook into a separate app. And I'm like, why? And it's like, well, the answer was another place to advertise. It was a separate monetization strategy. And that's what I'm like, I'm done. I erased Facebook off my phone. I'm like, you guys just... I barely like to use messages. Now I really don't want to use, I don't need another messaging application on my phone that exists purely so Facebook can capture this. It's like, I have email.
Oh,
Twitter.
Man. I don't know what it is about Facebook Messenger, but it is the worst variety of communication that I get.
Yeah.
Like, between the familiarity of it and the ease of doing it right there in that browser while people are already heated up about other stuff. And it's just, I don't know. There's just something that is awful about it and I hate it. And anybody that knows me well enough, I mean, look, I'm a public personality. I put multiple emails out for anybody to contact me. If you're a stranger, if you know me, you know my number. I mean, hell, if you don't know me, I gave my number, my real phone number out once on a live night attack. So it's like, you can get in touch with me. Facebook Messenger is a portal to hell.
Yeah. Somebody brings up Zoe Brings Bacon. A lot of my less techie friends use Messenger, so I feel obliged to use it. You know, and that's the hard choice, is that sometimes everybody else around us uses a thing. And I reached a point where I'm like, you know what? I'm going to be the weirdo. And I miss out. I know I miss out on a bunch of stuff because I've had friends like, oh, why'd you come to my party? I'm like, I didn't get an invite. No, I invited you on Facebook. And I'm like, I know you're going to think I'm going to sound like a caveman, but I'm actually talking about I'm the future man. Not everybody uses Facebook the way you use it. You know, Facebook is not the default way to do it. Not everybody has.
I don't use Facebook the I don't own a TV.
That's what people think it is, but it's not. It's really not, because it's not like, this is Facebook is this great big future. It's this, you know, I'm trying to figure out an analogy. It's like, oh, we all learned Esperanto. Why aren't you speaking in Esperanto now too? Because it's dumb. We have a really good way to do it. I have a good, perfectly good system called, you know, email to do this. And also it's like, everybody agrees. Oh yeah, I do spend too much time on Facebook. I do too much time. I spend too much time doing this. Great. I don't do it. You know, watching, saying I don't watch TV. Like, I don't. Well, again, do you watch TV?
I mean, I watch Netflix on TV.
Broadcast? Do you watch broadcast TV?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have Sling, so I have live television when I need it.
I haven't watched a broadcast television show. I can't even tell you. I mean, I've been in restaurants where they play, but I honest to God, I cannot tell you the last time I watched something like a regular commercial broadcast show with commercials. Like, I just...
Yeah. No, yeah. I have it for a few things that I'll watch live, but
yeah,
in general, it's I'm with you. I keep a Facebook page where I'll check it periodically, like on the desktop. But man, it's like the place with the cheapest gas on the edge of town, where there's like some ne'er-do-wells milling about, where it's like, hey, look, I'm going to stop there because I do. There's a few things that I like. Yeah. I can run and I can pick them up. But as soon as I'm there a little too long and I start to see all the shifty-eyed streetwalkers, I'm just like, nope, got to go. See you later.
Well, it Stryker Ridge fixed the TV snob alert. Let me be very clear. I love TV shows.
Yeah.
I love
shows. Yeah, yeah.
I just don't like TV. I don't like... It's because it's jarring when you haven't had to watch commercials and you're trying to watch a 30-minute sitcom and every 6 minutes you get served. I'm like, what the? I will pay to watch this. Like, I have Hulu without commercials. It's like $3 more to not get commercials. How much is my time worth?
Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, as far as moats, you know, the things that Netflix did, which was brilliant, Netflix started creating their own shows. Netflix says we could try to fight for movies, but then we're like a cable channel. We can try to fight for shows and TV series from other networks, or we can create a Netflix brand, kind of like what HBO did in, you know, back in the day. Netflix says, let's create our own content. Let's do that. And now what they've been doing, which is great, is the way they launch stuff is they always can have something that can be a conversation. You know, right now, you know, new season of Glow. So Glow becomes a conversation. You know, stuff that got Emmy nominations, that's a conversation. We're hearing, you know, stuff about Stranger Things in 2019, you know, yeah. And we're getting this. This is how we keep it relevant. There's a bus shelter near me when I go on for my walks. And it's funny because on one side of it, usually the ad is something that Netflix bought, and the other side of it, something Amazon Prime bought.
Oh,
and
really?
So when I walk there, I can see, and you realize that like Netflix, part of Netflix's goal is to increase growth rates. The reason shows get renewed on Netflix, the primary reason they get renewed on Netflix is if they increase user subscriptions. And that was the one of the, and maybe changing this now because user retention is critical too. But shows sometimes like, oh, I love this show, but yeah, but no new users came to this. No new subscribers came to the platform because of that. And that's what Netflix looks at. When they spent, you know, $100 million on certain programming like Baz Luhrmann's show, you know, and they're like, it did increase their user base by an appreciable amount. That show did not get renewed.
Yeah.
Because the expenditure. Versus other things. And so Amazon Prime uses shows is we want you to become a Prime member because we know we can creep that price of Prime up to it's like going to be like $120 a year. Fine. I'm fine with it. Totally fine.
I mean, because they did, to Amazon's credit, they keep making the deal sweeter when they push it up. And they've understood the Netflix lesson of like, hey, look, not every Netflix viewer is going to be the same person. And there are the people that are just there for the stand-up comedy. There are people who are just there for the dramas. There's people who are just there for this kind of programming. And they just want to make as many of those as possible, which is why, you know, Amazon with Amazon Prime, they'll find every little hook. Oh, do you shop at Whole Foods? Well, it's cheaper now that we own Whole Foods if you're a Prime member. Oh, do you or your kid watch Twitch all the time? Oh, well, you can let them subscribe to their favorite content and get all the little exclusive things. If you do this, we'll just keep one more thing. One, I don't know, original television. Do you like The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel? Well, congratulations. Now you have this new thing. So very, a very interesting proposition.
On this topic, a great book, Tim Wu's The Attention Merchants. I really, really, really love this book. I've mentioned it before. I like this book because he explains how the media landscape came about in kind of the early days of it, where it is wonderful. I just started listening to his new book, The Master Switch, and you read his comments and stuff. When he does editorials and stuff like this, I don't always necessarily agree with his, therefore, this is the solution. But his description of how we got to where we are and where we are, I think is spot on, extremely well researched. And somebody made a comment like, you know, the good thing about TV is you have the fast forward button. What's funny was if you remember the reaction to the DVR, television networks loathe the DVR. And it was hard to understand it until partially not too hard. But then when you put it in perspective and realize if you run a television network, your job is really you're running an ad agency. You are an ad agency. The shows are merely the things that go between the commercials and not vice versa. The shows go between the commercials. That's the way it works. And if people are fast forwarding through the commercials, then that's a problem. So that's a thing to think about. If you run a broadcast network, that is your job. You find things to put between your commercials. If you're cable, some degrees, but if you're pay cable, non-commercial, then yes, we're trying to create content. And it's the difference between, and it's why, it's a reason why network shows are probably never going to be as good as an HBO show, because a network show, all a network show needs to do is to make sure they have the attention span of an audience a certain amount of time to loop them through commercial to commercial to commercial and then get you into the next show.
Yeah.
If you can create a show that can then go into syndication, can last longer. But remember how like Seinfeld was very interesting. Like Seinfeld was a great example. This was a show the cost they paid more to their actors than it actually made in revenue in commercials when it aired.
Yeah.
A half hour of Seinfeld cost, you know, like cost like $10 million per episode, and it only made like $4 or $5 million or $3 million in commercials. And the reason they did this was because they knew if you watched that half hour of Seinfeld, you would watch the next half hour show, which was a lot cheaper to produce and probably stick around from there. And so if we started this big number and we keep decline, but still by the end of the night, we'll have a lot of people there following it. And so anyhow, that's, you know, kind of that model. That's why, because it's like, again, for broadcast, if they get rid of TV shows, which they slowly have been doing by, you look at the average running time of a TV show.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Well, and look, how many people in the audience right now know what an upfront is? Have you heard the term upfront? Because I would suspect that many do. And many of the, much of the time, specifically as online fandom has kind of become a bigger thing. Upfronts were like the line in the sand where you found out whether or not your favorite show was going to get renewed. That's where all the bubble the bubble shows would find out whether or not they were going to live or die. And you'd see, okay, oh, look, an exciting new show is coming next year. That's where you always see those weird super long previews that are basically like a cut-up version of the pilot that have like the beginning, middle, and end of the story. They come from the upfronts. Well, the upfronts are really, in reality, is a dog and pony show just to advertisers. They bring all the stars to New York. Again, New York, not L.A., despite the fact that most of these places are now functionally based out of Los Angeles. They all fly to New York so they can schmooze where advertising happens. And they try to get people into the tent for that. So it's like, that is the job. The job is to sell advertising. You can have a good show, but right now, like, but they don't really make money. You know, the shows don't make money unless they are just prime ad real estate. Somebody down here said, Greylock, cable companies want to continue to double dip because they get paid by ads and subscriptions. Yes, they do have an ad market, but think of cable company subscription fees as kind of like a relationship that cable that movie theaters have with movie studios. Like, they pay out a lot of that initial ticket is paid back to a studio when you go see it, in the same way that cable companies, that subscription is prorated for how much each channel is getting of your subscription. And that was a very interesting quirk that began in the 80s and 90s that really runs that cable business. So yeah, they do make money. That's the reason why your subscription keeps going up higher and higher, but they pay a lot of that out and then make money on the ads that they sell, and they keep that money. But even then, there's a reason why they're buying up that Comcast keeps buying up internet stuff. There's a reason why all these big telecoms continue to grow and grow in different unwieldy directions, because they need new places to sell ads because the subscriptions continue to go down.
It's a changing landscape, and it's going to be, you know, very interesting. With Hulu was an investment of NBC and some other media partners to try to say, we've got to do something because we know there's more people are watching. And when they first started Hulu, it was kind of a joke because it was like, yeah, pay for this. You also will get commercials, because that was the Hulu, the early days. The reason they like the paid tier still had commercials was because it was the TV mindset of, well, these people, if they can afford a Hulu subscription, we really want to advertise to them. We really want, it was, they're like, you know, there are people in the room, people are like, what are we going to do? We can't sell ads. And it's like subscription based. Then like, well, what's my job?
Yeah.
You know, and that's the changing. And the Netflix is like, no commercials. And I remember Netflix, like, we're going to streaming no commercials. Everybody were like, we'll see. And Netflix, like, yeah, and we're not going to sell downloads either. And people are like, we'll see. Now, Netflix is vulnerable in certain places. Their valuation, I think, is ridiculously high compared to what they are.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example. Like, I follow like the let me show you the valuation of Netflix as a the entirety of the company is a, where's my Netflix? Netflix is valued at $146 billion.
Jesus. Right?
I think I like Netflix. I love my Netflix, but I think that is an absurdly high valuation. IBM's $133 billion.
Yeah, I think that there's probably a little bit more of a tangible product to IBM as opposed to Netflix.
And I'll give you an example of Nike, $122 billion. So that I think that's sort of kind of a silly sort of. I think it's an outside. It's worth like one third of like Facebook, you know, which I think is absurd. Again, I love the company, but that value, yeah. That
and look, they've demonstrated that. They are able to do these things at a scale that I don't think a lot of people would have bet on. They have continued to do it, and they have succeeded in doing it for a very, very long time. Comparatively.
But like, so they're almost neck and neck with Disney's $167 billion, right? So Wall Street has said, yeah, we think Netflix is about as valuable as Disney to me, which is an absurd sort of rate. So Disney, as we talk about, Disney's going to be launching their own subscription service.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's going to be, I'm not going, well, great, I'll cancel my Netflix now. No. I'm like, no, I'll add the Disney one too. But it's that, does that now all of a sudden mean that, you know, I guess my point there is it's like, I invested in Apple back in 2001 because I looked at the valuation of Apple and it was extremely, I said, this is ridiculous. It's extremely undervalued for what they're doing. When they did the iPod and they nailed a really awesome consumer product, I said, this company, when they do have the engineering talent, the capability to do it. And I put a lot of money into Apple and it allowed me, afforded me the opportunity to squander that doing, you know, many crazy ventures and stuff like that, you know, and I've had that, you know, other examples of companies I felt the same way, like, you know, the IPO, when Tesla IPO, and I'm like, people don't get this company. I think I get it. But that's the thing is that you look at something, and you go like, I think this is kind of really undervalued, you know, Disney's, you know, PDE is like the ratio of profits to earnings to the stock share price. Disney's PDE is $15 per share. They're treated like a very traditional company. That's a very, very low. Netflix is 225%, you know, 225 PDE, you know. And so anyhow, long story short, I have no idea where the future of these things are going. But the trend is more subscription networks. And I think things like Patreon are great.
I agree.
Yeah.
I would love a service that just proactively canceled subscription services for me when I just didn't use them.
There are, which reminds me, I got to cancel my movie pass.
Oh God, I'll tell you what, that's a whole nother, maybe we can talk about that in after things. But I was thinking about that the other day. We're just like, if I'm not using it, just hit that, just go ahead and cancel it for me. And then when I like want to log back in, they'll be like, oh cool, we'll just get you back on.
Yeah, there's been a couple services that try to do that kind of thing that will like help you manage all of your subscriptions. And because like, yeah, I'm like, I know there's certain things I pay for that are stupid. And there's a business model there. It's like, we can find you a cheaper version of this or whatever. But yeah.
Yeah, I tried to watch a football game from Scotland when we were out there, and I wound up signing up for this service on this European website through ESPN. It was like ESPN's Watch International package or whatever, so I could watch the game. And then I realized like 6 months later that I was still paying that like $7 to this like European focused sports streaming offering from ESPN. And I'm like, ah man, I was getting in my own way here. All right. Let's go ahead and do picks. You got a pick here, Andrew?
I have my pick. I'm in the process of canceling my movie pass because I, you know, never used it. And I think they're going to probably not last long. My pick is going to be The Attention Merchants by Timothy Wu. Timothy Wu's book, I think, is a fantastic book, a great overview in history of just the entertainment industry, et cetera. So The Attention Merchants by Timothy Wu is my pick.
Fantastic. My pick is, where should I go? I mean, I've just been buried in this 1960 research. So I will go with The Real Making of the President. It is an answer to The Making of the President, the Theodore White story that was historically is understood to be very favorable to the Kennedy family, was brought in by the Kennedys. So The Real Making of the President, certainly not unsympathetic to Kennedy, but is very much an answer to that book and trying to point out things that are historically more well-known 40 years on than somebody who was writing. Theodore White wrote that book on the trail. And so, you know, I think he can historically be understood to have in a pre-mass media world to have kind of fallen into the universe a little bit. But the real making of the president, go ahead and find it.
You know, again, that's probably, you know, topic you've explored a lot more in your other sort of stuff, your mass media entertainment journalism empire. You know, it is that we form opinions about the information we're presented, and if we don't have information about the information, we're at a disadvantage. And particularly when it comes to things historically, you know, the winners, you know, the winners write history, you know, losers don't. We don't know. There's so much we don't know. The story of civilization is often told through the conquerors, and it's harder to find out about the conquered. And there have been attempts, you know, to try to address that. And so historically, like, what does the archaeological data show? Then you get, you know, counter histories, which are often, you know, well, this history is biased, so I'm going to write a biased history as a counter history, whatever. But I think that kind of comes to, there are people who, particularly, like, I can think in you know, politics, that, like, the historical versions, the accepted versions of it, because the ones were, at the time, had friendly relationships with the media, they got along really, really well with them, you know, of course, you know, they're going to be, you know, fondly remembered. And it's interesting because it's like I was looking at reading a book about kind of like defiance and people who worked against, you know, like who, you know, I think it was like 12 against the gods, 7 against the gods, I think against the gods, whatever. And I haven't read it yet, but one of the people they talk about is this, you know, historical figure that just fought against the odds is Woodrow Wilson, you know, and you're like, and it's sort of like, well, you know, yeah, you hold up the microscope to him in retrospect.
It's a different story. Yeah. You know, so in the research, the stuff I was reading this morning was about the famous Nixon-Kennedy debate, right? Which there is a lot to be understood and unpacked, and I suspect that it will be a large part of the podcast. But you know how many people watched the Nixon-Kennedy debate?
And let me tell you something here, because I have a vivid memory of one of my teachers in middle school or high school describing the debate to us. She described it. She didn't see it, but describing, you know, like, oh, one and what happened. I got the, oh, because Nixon looked like this and da da, and Kennedy was this, this, this. And then finally I watched it.
Yeah.
And it was like, this is not what you described. But go ahead. How many watched it? I would guess.
You guess how many?
Oh, I mean, what was the population at that time? Something like 120, 140 million people.
Yeah.
You know, what would be the average demographic of people watching? So it would have been 1959. I mean, like, a big audience share then. I mean, this is 1950. Was it
1960.
1960. So I would have guessed primaries. Yeah. I would say like 4 or 5 million.
No. Much more than that.
Really?
Yeah. Close to 70 million.
Watched it. Okay.
Watched it. It was certainly big news, but it's like, compare that to daily active users on a social
network. I'm just amazed there were that many TVs in households at that point, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, no. It was a huge event. There's a reason why it is understood to be the big mass media event that it was. But it's like, compare that. I mean, even then, we remember this on the level that we do because it was one of our first mass media memories, and it winds up becoming mythologized. And there's a lot of stuff that I've learned in researching it that goes contrary to popular understanding. There's a lot of lessons there. Anyway, listen, you guys are gonna hear me talk about 1960.
There were 70 million TV viewers then, so yeah, I guess that was like the entirety, because like, oh, it's all networks, all that too. So yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah,
I was just trying to figure like how many television, because like just how many television viewers, but also how many televisions.
I mean, there's also the question of, we don't really know. Like, it's not like we even had the kind of Nielsen technology that we have now, which is highly disputed on exact television viewership and exactly how much everybody watched it. So my wild guess is in 1960, there's quite a lot of guesswork as to how many people had the television on at the exact same time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd be curious, but I mean, like, there were 70 million televisions at that point, yeah. And then that's per household. And it's not like today where, you know, kids have a TV in their room or viewers. I don't know. But yes, everybody watched it. The funny thing is, like, yeah, like, I watched you when you watch the actual debate, like, you're expecting Kennedy to look like, you know, George Clooney or whatever, like this, and you know, you're like, well, this is, but the other thing too, it's like, if you ask people what the margins were, you know, did, you know, like, you know, the popular vote margins, people would think they're like, oh, Kennedy won in a landslide or whatever.
Oh God, no, certainly not.
It was like 2%, it's not even like less than a 1% difference.
Well, I mean, the vote. And that's before you get into stuff that people.
Yes, and yes.
Yeah.
If somebody should do a podcast on that.
I know. That they were about the same age, that they had almost the exact same political views, that, you know, Kennedy is somebody that gets to be young forever because of the tragic way that he died. And Nixon was somebody that not only aged, but aged into one of the, like, most reviled political monsters of all time. So it's like, that's one of those myths that I believe history built. That every year that passes, we remember it slightly differently because of what happened afterward. Yeah. Again, you guys are going to get sick of me talking about this one year in American history, so we can cut it off here. Andrew, anything that you want to get out there for everybody?
It's just my Shark Week show is supposed to air 2019, although I appeared on Cash Cab last Friday as a Shark Week personality promoting. So nothing like the long-term game there, folks. Long-term game. So
I saw a few of the on Twitter, just so everybody knows. This wasn't like an elaborate prank. Like, this is going to air next year. Television, ain't it a stinker?
Yeah. But it's funny these things. Like, people are like, how do you feel that you have to wait a year for it? I'm like, the experience I had was so awesome. It being a TV show is like, a TV. Okay, cool. It's cool. That's cool. I mean, people see it, but oh man, it was so cool to do this.
I mean, look. Andrew had an amazing time of his life and he got paid. It's up to Discovery to air the show.
Well, 2019, yeah.
In 2019.
Yeah.
You can only, Shark Week happens but once a year. So it's not like it's a special. It's like, oh, we'll push it back to the holidays. There's no Shark Week in December. And you know, in the way that there's no Christmas in July.
Yeah.
All right. Folks, tell you what, if you like me talking about politics, you go ahead and get me on the free political newsletter. Get it at freepoliticalnewsletter.com.
Sweet. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.